My biggest qualm is not so much with people on the internet, and I couldn't get into this as much in Marie Claire as I wanted to, but my issue is with the media itself and the abhorrent way they cover these harassment campaigns. They often re-victimize women. They often reveal highly personal information.
So the last thing that I made with my butcher box shipment was aloo chicken, and it turned out really well. One of my favorite things is to get the shipment and then open up the New York Times cooking app and see what I want to create over the next few weeks. It helps my creative cooking chops, and both my wife and I really enjoy it. ButcherBox offers a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing price, plus they have exclusive member deals, and they also have their own recipes, although I am preferential to the New York Times app, but that's just me. And you can sign up today at butcherbox.com/conspirituality and get their special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. So for that year, you can choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/conspirituality and use code conspirituality to choose your free for a year offer, plus get $20 off your first order.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey everyone, welcome to Conspirituality, where we investigate the intersection of conspiracy theories and spiritual influence to uncover cults, pseudoscience, and authoritarian extremism. I'm Derek Barris.
I'm Matthew Remsky.
I'm Taylor Lorenz.
Awesome. Welcome, Taylor. We are on Instagram and Threads at Conspirituality Pod, and you can access all of our episodes ad-free, plus our Monday bonus episodes over on Patreon, or you can just grab our bonus episodes via Apple subscriptions. As independent media creators, we appreciate your support. Conspirituality 191, extremely online with Taylor Lorenz. The internet has changed not only how we communicate with each other, but how we understand the world. All technologies reorient how we navigate our shared spaces. This one just feels at times so disorienting, especially if you are, like the three of us here today, extremely online. And that's the title of Washington Post columnist Taylor Lorenz's recent book. Taylor has been covering internet culture since starting in social media for the Daily Mail in 2011, which led to positions as a technology reporter for Business Insider, The Daily Beast, and The New York Times. In her insightful and excellent book, she details the history of internet culture, and she joins us today to discuss reporting in an age of conspiracy theories and online trolling, the challenges of covering long COVID in an age of overwhelming health misinformation, and what it's like to be extremely online. So welcome, Taylor. And I have to say that I do still spend some time on Twitter. I kind of have to, I'm sure like you do, for our jobs. Yeah. And every day when I open it up, I'm kind of like, are you trending this day? Because very often you are. So very happy that you're here.
I'm keeping Elon in business, honestly. After getting banned from Twitter, you know, Elon banned myself and a bunch of other journalists, let all of us back on. And after that, I put my account on private and I've never taken it off private again, nice. Honestly.
You know, I wanted to start, Taylor, by asking you for your elevator pitch or maybe, let's say, TikTok script about what it means to be extremely online.
Oh my gosh, good question. I would say being extremely online means spending an enormous amount of time, consuming media on the internet and being being up with culture, online culture. I feel like there's not a huge distinction between online culture and culture now, but sort of speaking the language of the internet, I guess.
Right.
You've posted about this, and I think it's very big in our general journalism circles, which is the Ezra Klein op-ed about the middle collapsing in journalism recently. And this has, so the instinct has long been to blame the internet for the collapse of journalism. And that's true for some publications that haven't caught up. I remember I was a magazine editor and they didn't want to go online at first and all of this. But media scholars have pointed out that the middle started collapsing in the early 90s when private equity started buying up news organizations, and recent data bear that out. So Klein's case is that you have these top tier entities like the New York Times, which he wrote the piece for and works for. And then you have independent media creators, some of them who are doing very well or just surviving. But there's an entire class of knowledge work and valuable information from those organizations that has flatlined or is really struggling. Now, given that you've written an excellent book about the evolution of social media and our online spaces in general, what impact has social media had on this process, and how do you foresee it going a bit in the future?
Yeah, I agreed with Ezra's piece, and I think private equity has been corrosive and horrible in the media industry. What I argue kind of in my book is that social media has accelerated the demise of sort of legacy media and other legacy institutions, and specifically this sort of content creator class, which is essentially independent media operating online. I think they've kind of rushed in to fill the information void that's been left by the death of local media, niche media, you know, that whole like middle ground of digital media. Like as all of those news organizations have gone out of business or, you know, shut down, I think now you see the only people sometimes covering specific areas or industries or genres of sort of coverage are these content creators on the internet.
Right. Well, I mean, we're not just talking about industry shifts and erosions and collapses. We're also talking about people. And in so many ways, your own career has like navigated this chaos in real time, I think. I mean, you're still on staff at WAPO, where you have access to like all of this editorial fact-checking, legal resources, you know, everything that would go along traditionally with a fourth estate. But, you know, we're seeing those walls crumble. We're seeing a job loss bloodbath for so many of our colleagues. And at the same time, it seems like you're increasing, along with a lot of other people, your independent creator footprint on TikTok and Substack.
I started as an independent creator. I started in 2009 as a blogger.
Right.
So the only reason I got that job years later at the Daily Mail in social media is because I had been blogging and I became popular on the internet. And so at that time, you couldn't monetize your social media presence very well. Like I had a couple friends that were running banner ads on their Tumblrs, and I had a ton of viral Tumblrs, but like there was the sort of like the only on-ramp to like monetizing was to sort of like go in-house in an agency, which I started working doing social media for brands and then got into media that way. But yeah, 100%. And I think it's important to have that. I always wonder sort of if I had been instead of a blogger, like, you know, started 5 years later, I don't think I would have ever ended up in traditional media because I would have been able to monetize, like the monetization ecosystem was further along.
So it's really strange that you're actually coming back to independent creator status in some ways.
Yeah.
Right. At the end of a long, strange trip. Yeah.
Maybe I made the wrong choice. But I mean, my feeling is always like, and part of the reason I wanted to like work at these like old school institutions, I guess, is that I feel like journalism is incredibly valuable. And I think there's, even though I'm a huge critic of the mainstream media, there's a reason to preserve it. And I think if it's, people don't realize the sort of importance of news coverage until it's gone and hollowed out. So
I am seeing some hope with journalists banding together. You know, you have Platformer, which is smaller, but Casey does great work. You have 404 Media, you have Defector. I just learned about somewhere called Fourth.News today, which is also another group of journalists. So I think there hopefully will be some hope with the journalists being able to get some sort of resources, maybe nonprofit status. Are you aware of any other organizations that are doing this that you're appreciating?
Yeah. I mean, Amir Al-Khattabi, who runs the Instagram account at Muslim. He runs Muslim News. It's a big podcast. And, you know, he has a daily newsletter. He's an independent journalist. I think he's like 24, 25 years old, but he has been, you know, leading the way on so much coverage of Gaza. He's actually in touch with the Muslim journalists on the ground. And I think he's done a great job of building this independent media company. And I think he has a couple staffers now too, that filled a void, which the mainstream media was not covering Muslim issues very well. A lot of it had very racist and problematic undertones. And he stepped in and I think has done just such an amazing job. But this is a kid that graduated from journalism school, basically couldn't get a job in traditional journalism, ended up sort of building these viral accounts, and now is kind of like trying to figure it all out. I mean, can barely figure out how to monetize, basically is relying on like piecemeal grants from people. So I don't like love that that is the, you know, I wish we had more infrastructure in place to support people like Amir and others. You know, I think that it's great to see, I mean, I'm a huge fan of 404. I'm obsessed with them, like, you know, and a lot of these other independent sites, but that's great for more of like the mid-career journalists that already have the following that then can then like take their institutional knowledge and spin out. I'm worried about this generation of journalists that's upcoming.
Yeah.
You know, because they'll never get that newsroom experience, which is incredibly valuable.
Yeah, yeah. There's one story that you tell in Extremely Online that I want to flesh out because it's very pertinent to our beat, and that's the Gamergate to Trump pipeline. So you mark Gamergate as being the point where this extremely crude, predominantly right-wing trolling emerged and then accelerated. So what happened with that event to give rise to such a jarring phenomenon that we now have to deal with on a daily basis?
As I talk about in my book, Gamergate was sort of this blueprint for online harassment and how to exploit the media. It's kind of like served as this test case almost of how to mainstream reactionary ideology, weaponize the internet to promote your views, and essentially, you know, exploit the media's tendency to kind of like both sides issues to kind of like mainstream a lot of really horrible regressive ideas and generate controversy, manufacture controversy around women, marginalized groups, and sort of oust them from prominent positions. Literally, I mean, we just saw this happen with Claudine Gay recently and the whole Harvard fiasco. And this playbook has been run a million times over, but I think that that was very much like the genesis of it. And I think that that moment of Gamergate 2 provided a lot of awareness where like suddenly I think other people watching like trolls, bad actors were like, oh, this is a successful formula that we can just run up endlessly. And now we're caught in these endless sort of like manufactured culture wars because of it.
You know, at the heart of that story was this territorial misogynistic resentment over a woman game developer, Zoe Quinn, who she dared to use game tech to explore depression instead of single shooter violence. And so it became this microcosm of the gendered and political ground war between 4chan and Tumblr over what the internet is for and like who gets to be listened to. So, you know, my question is, we all know who won in terms of political influence, but I'm wondering if you think it could have at some point been possible for the left to mobilize Tumblr in the same way that the right mobilized the Manosphere.
I mean, 100%. I say that as a former Tumblr person. Yeah. Tumblr gave me everything. But I think Tumblr, you know, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, but I think, I mean, you could write a whole book on sort of like Tumblr's role in sort of political ideology. Tumblr was so progressive in so many ways to the point that it's a joke. I mean, people make memes about it of like your brain poison self on, you know, Tumblr in 2011, hearing the worst takes imaginable. But, you know, that was where a lot of the sort of body positivity movement came from. It's where a lot of sort of, you know, LGBTQ sort of changing notions of gender identity and how we think about gender constructs came from Tumblr. So much sort of leftist thinking came from those spaces. But I think the fact that is that the platform itself was not built to support it. I mean, I wish that more people had taken it seriously. I think it was dismissed institutionally by a lot of journalists who just immediately hopped over to Twitter once Twitter started to gain traction. And also just the platform, like the people running it when it was acquired by Yahoo 2013, they just didn't understand what they had. And I think that they, you know, certainly didn't build any sort of like tools or features that could have allowed it to be a better place for activism.
It wasn't a place of you know, aggressive externalized campaigning either, right?
Yeah.
It was a it was a place of development, developing ideas, debating ideas, self-reflection, self-criticism, sometimes, you know, to a fault. But the function of that space, as far as I understand it, was just not, you know, parallel to the function of 4chan and, you know, the sites that wound up creating these waves of online aggression.
Right. And also, I mean, 4chan specifically, and I talk about this a little bit in my book, they had been sort of increasingly exerting their power on the internet for years by the time Gamergate came around. I mean, they were instrumental in all of those early YouTube viral videos that we all know and love. I talk about Tay Zonday's Chocolate Rain in my book. And, you know, this is a song by a, you know, an autistic Black man who was writing about systemic racism. But it was because he was sort of so awkward and stuff, 4chan would make these people famous and they would manipulate the YouTube, you know, system to kind of get him on the homepage and amass views. And I think that sort of like gave them a taste of power almost, like that community. And they would get things upvoted on Dig and other things. Like they sort of really realized early that the internet is built for this sort of collective action. And I think soon they went from sort of having funny people trending on YouTube or whatever to, yeah, these more political campaigns.
So one thing I just missed is Vine. As you can see behind me, I read a lot and I like videos, but like 6 seconds, I was always like, ignore. And you write about the way that the Viners game the algorithm and how much attention they spent to creating the 6 second. That part blew my mind. I had no idea.
I mean, Vine was so interesting because I think it's probably one of the most culturally relevant apps to exist in the past decade. And it was really only around for a couple years in its peak. It was really 2014 and 2015. By the end of 2016, it had shut down. In 2013, it was sort of just beginning to emerge. And it launched the careers of some of the biggest names on YouTube today. I think the downfall of that platform was ultimately Twitter and mismanagement and the fact that they didn't respect content creators. I talk about this sort of pivotal moment in my book when the content creators actually recognized their power collectively and sort of took collective action against the platform, ultimately leading to its demise. You know, I wish we saw more of that today from some content creators. I think they don't generally have that sort of solidarity. It was a smaller group, you know.
So we have a legacy of some Vine creators who made it to YouTube and created a kind of career continuity there. But was there also like a formal or a technical, I don't know, echo that the platform left? Do we see the influence of Vine on TikTok now?
Oh, yeah.
Just in terms of speed and edits?
100%. I mean, Vine was the first mainstream mobile video editing app. Right. You could not post video easily on the internet before Vine. It's hard to remember, but Instagram was only photos. Twitter did not have video support. You had to sort of like upload through this website, YFrog or whatever. It was like, there was all these like third party kind of tools that sometimes will let you upload a clip and it took like 20 minutes. Vine, it was very easy. It was point and shoot. You just press down, you know, on the screen to record. And you could just very easily post content. And so, I think the ripple effects are felt, you know, enormously. And also, as I write about in my book, that sort of the death of Vine led to the birth of Musical.ly. And Musical.ly, of course, is what eventually became TikTok and is probably undeniably the most influential social media app of the last several years. But I think there's so much roots of Vine and Vine culture in all video editing platforms today, but especially TikTok.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the I Can't Sleep podcast with Benjamin Boster. If you're tired of sleepless nights, you'll love the I Can't Sleep podcast. I help quiet your mind by reading random articles from across the web to bore you to sleep with my soothing voice. Each episode provides enough interesting content to hold your attention, and then your mind lets you drift off. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. That's I Can't Sleep with Benjamin Boster.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. Do you want a new podcast to look forward to each week? One that's entertaining, informative, and packed with actionable content? Come on. Of course you do. The average podcast listener has 6 shows in rotation, so you're most likely not just listening to Conspirituality. And that's totally okay. I'd love to share a podcast to add to your list. The Jordan Harbinger Show is a top shelf podcast named Best of Apple in 2018. So don't just ignore my suggestion to listen to this one like you probably do with your other friends who tell you to listen to podcasts. Jordan dives into the minds of fascinating people, from athletes to scientists, political activists, mobsters, even hostage negotiators. And Harbinger has an undeniable talent for getting his guests to share never-before-heard stories and thought-provoking insights. Without fail, he pulls out tactical bits of wisdom in each episode, all with the noble cause to make you more informed, a critical thinker, and to better operate in today's world. I was on his show. In preparation, I listened to a bunch of episodes. He's just really good at what he does. Like episode 880 features Ian Bremmer, you know, the top-notch political scientist, and the topic is dealing with a world in disarray. But then you have episodes like his skeptical Sunday format, episode 882 looked at homeopathy. But he has other episodes on Ayurveda and also the popular pseudoscience of analyzing body language. There isn't a better podcast to listen to casually or seriously to expand your worldview. He's also got a strangely relatable weekly segment called Feedback Friday, where Jordan covers advice on everything from escaping a cult or a psycho family situation to relationships and networking, and even to asking for a raise. So point blank, Jordan Harbinger is smart, funny, he's easy to listen to. You'll be pressed to find an episode without excellent conversation, a few laughs, and even actionable advice that you can directly use to improve your life. You can't go wrong with adding The Jordan Harbinger Show to your rotation. It's incredibly interesting. There's never a dull show. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now, you do such a good job at contextualizing the internet and media and social media and how it's evolved. But last year, I talked to Tobias Rose Stockwell about the history of media in general, which got me on this trip of reading multiple books about where media comes from. And honestly, like if you go back 500 years, you have subscription model and you have the ad model. The first really successful American newspaper was the New York Sun. It sold ads to support the fact that it was always telling stories about bat boys on the moon, right? But as you write about, then you get to this space where Logan Paul is live streaming a dead body in Japan and Elle Mills is marrying her sister's boyfriend for clicks and then discovers it's really hard to get a legal divorce. And so what I'm wondering from your perspective, we talk a little bit about like the middle, but then these newer people who want to create, and monetize and be able to survive doing what they do. Do social media creators have to live by the same principles as traditional journalists?
No. I mean, I think what's different is that you're working for the incentives of these algorithms and platforms rather than the incentives of your employer. And look, undeniably, these larger media companies are also built off subscription models and views, but they have their own, they're not living in a distributed manner across platforms. They have their own website generally or product that they put out, magazine, whatever. And so they're not beholden as much to those platforms. Of course, they still rely on those platforms for audience growth, but they could, you could take the Washington Post off social media tomorrow and you would still have the WashingtonPost.com and, our print paper and all of that. Social media content creators don't generally own their audience. So they might have a newsletter. That's like the closest thing that they would have to something that probably can't be deleted. But most of their content lives across these social platforms. So they really have to optimize for each platform. And that leads to very, very warped incentives, as you mentioned, like this like views culture. It leads to sort of extremism, this like eye catching. It's all about sort of like grabbing attention. And look, I'm not going to say that news organizations don't engage in clickbait and, you know, SEO like type of trickery and all of that. But fundamentally, the structure of the organization is set up for that. A lot of journalists to just be able to work without worrying about that stuff. Whereas there's no world that a social media content creator can work without worrying about those algorithms because their work fundamentally depends on it.
Following up on that, I find that you and Derek are both super adaptable journalists in ways that I really envy. And you have always, it seems, brought your chops and integrity to a variety of platforms. And now there's an even accelerated or raised demand for quick attention capture. I'm looking through your TikTok material. And at this point, you know, you have to make a lot of that happen on your own as you're talking about the withdrawal of various supports, you know, and that's, of course, running according to the logic of the algorithm. So I wanted to know, just in terms of, you know, professional consideration and standards and how you feel your work is changing or maybe not changing, what are the pros and cons of your reporting beginning to mirror the forms of creator class media?
Yeah, well, I think starting as a blogger, like I've always kind of written for the internet, and I've always said, I mean, part of the way that I got jobs in traditional media, every single place I'd interview, I'd be like, I do not care about writing for print. So many places, I think when you interview at these legacy places, the people want to be in the magazine or whatever. And I was always just like, put my work on the internet. It's the only thing I care about. And I, you know, so in that sense, it's not anything like new, I would say. I always think about sort of how my work is perceived online. And by the way, as we all should, in the sense that that is where our audience is and that is where our readers are, and we want to ultimately serve our readers. I think it's been a double-edged sword, though. I mean, it is frustrating when you work incredibly hard and then you post something and it doesn't get traction online and you're like, oh my God, this reporting took me like 6 months or whatever, right?
Right.
But in those stories, often you're hoping for impact in other ways, whether it's changing legislation or sort of affecting key decision makers in certain areas, whatever. I think overall, though, at least the way I feel about creating content online and social media is that it helps build trust. You know, people don't trust journalists at all generally because we have a lot of distrust in the mainstream media. And I do think that being out there and being present and being accountable and responding to people, obviously not trolls, but, you know, like it can be a good thing. It can be a good thing to engage the public and kind of test ideas. And for someone like me that writes about a very consumer-y kind of beat, it's good. Now, do I think our national security reporters need to be doing that? No, and they shouldn't have to be, you know? But for someone that covers the internet, I want as much sort of real-time feedback on my story ideation as possible because I'm writing about communities often that I'm not even a part of, you know? So I'm usually very open with my ideas and develop my stories in tandem with the audience.
Well, I mean, you do get a lot of feedback and you also get an incredible amount of blowback. Yeah. And so I wanted to ask you about one particular you know, famous now scenario. I think that somebody had to unmask Chaya Rajcik. And, you know, I think it makes sense, maybe even on kind of like a mythological level, that it was you. But looking at how she has, you know, ascended to a position of political power now, you know, recently having accepted a public post in Oklahoma, what are your reflections on what this tells us about like the premises of investigating and unmasking characters like this?
She's always had political power. And that was one of the bars. You know, I had been watching her for a long time since Rogan first mentioned her. And she started to sort of gain a lot of traction online. I feel like from covering content creators, you always can see who's going to blow up. Always. I mean, I did the first post on Charli D'Amelio. Like anytime someone's blowing up, like I start to notice. And usually they get on my radar and I start monitoring them. With her, she was very weird about her identity. As you said, she was like obscuring her identity. And there was this increasing sort of influence that she was amassing. At the point that I had written about her, she was being constantly mentioned on Joe Rogan. She had appeared multiple times on Fox without her face being shown, but through voice.
Right.
She was giving interviews saying quite inflammatory things to right-wing media outlets like the New York Post and others. She was essentially acting as an assignment producer for all of the right-wing media, where she was like, you know, determining what the stories would be of the day and stuff, and like really affecting news coverage that then would trickle out into the New York Times and elsewhere. And she, Ron DeSantis's press secretary, said that she was directly informing the anti-LGBTQ legislation that was being passed in Florida. In my opinion, at that point, and she was, by the way, the trajectory of her growth continued to escalate. In my opinion, that makes you a public figure and worthy of scrutiny.
Right.
And I didn't believe that she should be able to operate in that way, affecting our laws, affecting our education system, affecting our media climate anonymously. And so I mean, I talked to Dave Weigel about it at the time. I remember when I started the Post and I was like, if she keeps going like this, I'm going to report about it. Because the thing is, her identity would have come out probably eventually. I mean, I know Travis Brown had exposed a bunch of stuff. Like, there were these researchers talking about her, but nobody had really interrogated her and looked into her. And by the way, she had also accepted millions of dollars of funding from Seth Dillon, by the way, at that point too. So in no way was this woman some random private figure in any capacity. And I totally don't regret that story at all, you know?
Oh, of course. I'm thrilled that you did it. I guess one of the premises that, you know, everybody has as investigators is this belief that sunlight is the best disinfectant, that if a person is like fully exposed and interrogated for who they are, that, you know, nature will heal. And I'm wondering what your experience has been with that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. And I've had this with so many content creators that I've written about that are kind of bad, that have done bad things. And in some ways, you know, people always say, oh, don't give them attention. Don't give them attention. We need to give these people scrutiny. And by the way, me writing about her did not make, she was already on a rocket ship. Like,
yeah.
And with the funding that she had gotten and the backers that she had gotten and the political influence she had amassed, by the time I wrote about her, there's no world where I didn't write that story and then she goes away. No, that's a huge calculation that I take into account. And there's a lot of people that I write about that I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to give this person oxygen because I do think they are floundering and might be on the downturn.
Right.
Not with her. She was always sort of like, you know, the right manufactures these personalities and stars, and they had sort of chosen her. I think it's always a weird sort of balance, and I knew the backlash that I was going to get, and that's why I made such an effort to reach out to her for comment, famously knocking on her door, which, you know, is something that, by the way, journalists do all the time. Like, just, we're constantly knocking on doors for comment or chasing someone down for comment, you know, like, especially if you're going to reveal someone's identity, I wanted to sort of like, you know, give her the chance to comment on the record.
We had Jeff Charlotte on recently, and he talks about that because his job involves driving across country into MAGA land and knocking on people's doors when he sees MAGA flags. And he's like, you have to be comfortable as a journalist doing that, or else you're not going to actually succeed in that career.
Absolutely. Yeah. One thing I think is hilarious is that I revealed absolutely no information in my article that could be used to find Haya's address. Zero. Zero. All I said in my article is that she lived in Los Angeles. I absolutely did not link to or show anything that even remotely could be used to find where she lived. However, she tweeted a photo of me on her doorstep, which showed not only the street in LA that she lived on, but the exact house that she lived in.
Yeah, she doxed herself, basically.
And that was before my article even went up. So I don't want to hear for a second that I doxed this woman.
Oh, that's wow. So you mentioned watching people's trajectories and identifying them. So we have to briefly discuss one of my least favorite people in the world, Chris Rufo. You shared a New York Times article about America being under attack from anti-DEI activists. I'm doing a brief on this next week. One of my best friends is a longtime DEI facilitator. It's just nonsense. It was a great piece. But as you pointed out, the New York Times is responsible for promoting the message of the people like Rufo in the first place. Now, I'm not trying to throw the Times under the bus. I've been subscribing for a long time. Okay, but so can you have it both ways in today's political environment? What are your thoughts on that example, but more broadly, what that represents?
Yeah, what it represents is exactly what got us into this problem in the first place. The reason that bad actors like Chris Rufo are so effective is because they leverage places like the New York Times that will launder their extremist ideology for a liberal audience. And they do this constantly. They do this with trans issues. They do this with, you know, the war right now. They do this with everything. They do this with COVID. They constantly sort of mainstream these really extreme thoughts and campaigns for this allegedly sort of progressive mainstream neoliberal audience. And it's so incredibly irresponsible. And for them to then turn around and kind of like write about it in this way just shows that they are very aware of what they're doing. I mean, I was appalled to see the New York Times essentially reblogging the Free Beacon in one of their articles, like quoting it without... And this is a website where there is an entire article claiming that I am a lizard person on, you know, like this is not a legitimate news outlet in any sense of the word. And yet by treating it as one and by citing it in the New York Times, I mean, it's so incredibly irresponsible. And I can say, having worked there for years, it's from the top. It's the editors at the top that just fundamentally, you know, I think, frankly, are sympathetic to a lot of these extreme sort of ideologies, and they like to play both sides of the coin. And it's so harmful.
Yeah, I mean, the vibe is definitely not afflict the comfortable, but a kind of generalized, like moving along attitude towards all of these compounding and accelerating human tragedies. And as you say, we see it in a lot of issues. There's COVID revisionism, like should we have really closed schools, to climate apathy, to the trend of writing about death in Gaza and the passive voice. So I guess I wanted to ask whether, you know, even if the industry wasn't contracting, do you think that these center-right, very top-down trends would be pushing you personally towards freelancing anyway?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's never been my aspiration to work at any of these mainstream places. I mean, I remember when the Times was recruiting me very aggressively, I was like, why would I don't see myself as part of that? And this is before I would, now knowing what they've published recently and being more familiar with their work, I honestly don't know morally how I would feel about working there, seeing what they've done the past few years. But, you know, I still work for another institution that publishes a lot of stuff I don't agree with. It's a trade-off. I think, you know, every journalist kind of has to make that decision for themselves. My whole thing was like, I really wanted to sort of bring online culture to the mainstream media, make people care, make internet culture reporting a real beat that people hire for and is taken seriously as traditional tech reporting. And I think I've accomplished most of that. But, you know, I don't know. I think that I'm glad that we have the internet in cases when the New York Times publishes all of this crazy stuff, because I remember sort of a little bit after September 11th in the Iraq War. I mean, I was a kid, but I remember how extreme it was. Like, I do remember a teacher or something saying they were against the war, and there was like a huge problem at our school.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm glad that we have spaces where people can sort of challenge mainstream narratives. The problem is then like those are also full of bad actors that are like leveraging that, you know, to push even more extreme bad ideas. So.
Well, speaking about mainstream narratives, you have been posting quite a bit about COVID and long COVID. And my bet is that the visibility of long COVID as a public health crisis will increase through the activism of people who are suffering with it. And that's going to be, you know, against the grain of all of the back to work repressions of the state. And many of the most prominent long COVID advocates I follow on socials are women. And so I'm wondering if you see at this point a kind of higher stakes reprise of that, you know, 2010's rise of women bloggers who were willing to talk about mental health and parenting struggles in ways that MSM outlets weren't willing to cover. Is that happening again?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's so incredible to have these amazing patient advocates and that are primarily women. I mean, we know that long COVID overwhelmingly affects women more. Women have very different immune profiles than men. That's why women are more likely to get autoimmune disease generally and For so many reasons. Also, the way that women's immune system behaves during pregnancy is very different. So, women are very high risk for long COVID compared to men, although obviously it still affects countless men, and COVID will harm anybody that it infects. It's, nobody is free from that. But I think it's made it actually much easier for the establishment to dismiss it. I mean, you look at, for instance, the journalists that cover this stuff, and even my sort of vocal activism around it, like, it's constantly referred to as hysteria and women. And look yeah. at, there's so many parallels, as many people have pointed out, that half, of people with long COVID are meet the diagnostic criteria for ME/CFS. I don't know if people know about ME/CFS, but it is one of the most debilitating, horrific diseases that you can have. It is sort of like, basically like zaps your energy. I don't know how to put it, but it's like you're moving through molasses every day. And that is, millions and millions of people, primarily women, have suffered with ME/CFS for years. And there's no coverage of it. There's no investment in fixing it. And I think that's primarily because it affects women. And when you're doing activism, it's very hard when you have no energy. That's the whole problem. And that's why, you see these activists within long COVID as well, just at the recent Senate hearing on it, having to recover. It's enormously taxing on their bodies. And so you're asking disabled people, and by the way, at least one person attended those hearings and then was reinfected with COVID, potentially endangering their lives because yeah. people like Bernie Sanders and others couldn't even be bothered to mask throughout the whole hearing. Crazy. But, it's at great cost to their bodies, and it's horrible. And I was very heavily involved in sort of AIDS activism growing up, and did a lot in that area. And a lot of it's sort of like reminiscent of that, of the sort of just like the state abandonment, the normalization of infection, the refusal to sort of adapt protective measures. And, that took decades. I'm hopeful that the internet can sort of accelerate change and people can start to realize this is a workers' rights issue. Those people that are working these, manual labor or service jobs, they are the ones being forcibly affected. Let's not forget In-N-Out banned masks. They won't even let their employees protect themselves. So I just think this is a mass disabling event, and I hope that leftists could have some solidarity. It's been very disappointing to see a lot of them not, basically.
Well, and then on a sort of more mainstream left-leaning level, it's extraordinary that in the aftermath of the greatest public health crisis in the last 100 years, like things like Medicare for All aren't even on the agenda, right?
They're
like,
not even talking about it.
Right.
They're not even talking about it. I know. I remember when the pandemic hit and I was like, wow, this is horrible, but maybe we're going to get healthcare,
Sure.
And in fact, we have big leftist organizations, shouting down disabled people who are talking about these things. And that is incredibly problematic, especially when the most marginalized people, it's not just women, it's people of color are more likely to be affected by COVID. It's it sort of exacerbates all of these inequalities. And by the way, the majority, I have 7 shots myself. I'm severely immunocompromised. I don't even generate antibodies to the vaccines, but, it's great to be vaccinated, but long COVID is very common in breakthrough infections. Being vaccinated does not mean that you can't get long COVID in any sense of the word. And that it might help reduce, the severity and the symptoms and things. So definitely great, get all of your vaccines and boosters. But, I think far too many people drank up the Kool-Aid and the, back to work messaging of, this sort of vaxxed and relaxed approach, where they don't realize that they're in danger until they're disabled. And then no one's there to help them.
If you're a fan of workplace comedies like The Office or satire like The Onion, then I have a podcast that I know you'll love. It's called Mega. Mega is an improvised satire from the staff of a fictional mega church. That's the premise. Each week, the hosts, Holly Laurent and Greg Hess, are joined by guests, people like Cecily Strong or Jen Hatmaker, to portray characters inside the colorful world of Twin Hills Community Church, which they describe as a mega church with a tiny family feel. The result is a sharp-witted and hilarious look into the world of commercialized religion using humor to cope with the frightening amount of power that church and religion have. So I very much recommend you checking out Mega's episodes, like the one with Saturday Night Live's Cecily Strong, playing CeCe String, a hilarious character who's fresh out of jail, and also comedian Jason Mantzoukas. You may find yourself dying of laughter and perhaps inspired to take an improv class yourself. Mega is able to keep you laughing as you think and reflect about the world we live in. You can find Mega on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Well, what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field. And we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Spending way too much time on social media? Derek here from Conspirituality, and you might be able to break the cycle of doom scrolling on Elon Musk's haunted Twitter by tuning into the Crooked Media podcast Offline with Jon Favreau. I have been a Crooked Media fan since the company was founded, and I'm really excited to be talking about Offline because it's a different kind of Sunday show. It's a chance to step outside our social media fueled news cycles and hear smarter, lighter conversations about how chronically online existence shapes the way that we live, work, and interact with the world around us. Each week, Jon Favreau is joined by notable guests like Stephen Colbert, Hassan Piker, ContraPoints, Margaret Atwood, what? All for intimate conversations about how to live happier, healthier lives, both on and offline. New episodes of Offline with Jon Favreau drop every Sunday, wherever you get your podcasts. Health information is obviously a foundational reason of why we started the podcast with the anti-vax movement, but its tentacles spread out into so many different directions. I'm writing a piece about health misinformation and AI for Mother Jones right now, and it's something that's fascinating to me because I go to the chatbots to like ask the same questions I would traditionally do search on, and the amount of sort of collated misinformation that I'm fed, especially in Copilot and sometimes ChatGPT, kind of blew my mind. So I pitched this story. And a lot of the focus right now in media is on election interference through AI, which we should be focusing on. But I'm telling you, the health stuff, Copilot will literally tell me one thing and then sell me the products under it that it just said not to take. So we're moving. We're moving into very. It's like don't take turmeric supplements. Just eat the actual turmeric if you want these anti-inflammatory benefits. Oh, and buy all of these supplements. That's what I'm looking at right here. So I'm just wondering your general thoughts because we've kind of talked about media up until now and what people are trying to do, but given that Google might make their search page just information collected from all these news sites without actually referencing them anymore, that to me is another existential, I don't want to say crisis, but we're definitely dealing with something new here. And I'm wondering your thoughts about how AI is affecting media from your perspective.
Yeah, I think AI is just an accelerant of a lot of these trends that we're already seeing emerging of sort of like the fracturing of media and the rising distrust and misinformation being so rampant. But I think it's going to make it, I think it's going to make it significantly worse. Also because people treat AI, as you know, as this like all-knowing, all-powerful thing. I think some people have a skepticism of it, but even the most skeptical people will still rely on information or not even think to question information. And I mean, we already know that media literacy is at an incredible low. I mean, most people can't even distinguish between an opinion article and a reported, you know, news article. So they're certainly not going to be able to parse the nuances of a sort of ChatGPT given answer at all. They're probably just going to read it and skim it and absorb it. And even if they're kind of skeptical of some of it, it doesn't matter that misinformation has been repeated and sort of put into your brain. And now it's something that you probably might think about, even if you don't necessarily fully believe. So I think it's a really bad thing. I think that somebody should fix that.
I have a couple of questions, maybe as we round up here, about this personal account that you published back in October in Marie Claire about dealing with levels of online harassment that I think most people and certainly men just can't even imagine. So I'm not going to ask you to recite any of the horrible details, but there's two things that stood out to me. One of them was that I was reminded of interviewing Kathleen Hale. I don't know if you remember her story, but she was a young author or a young adult fiction author who was also doing a lot of personal essays back in the 2010s. And she made the choice to write a long disclosure of how she had actually stalked somebody on Goodreads who had given her a bad review. And then that actually led to this full-on sort of cancellation campaign against her. But what she was saying was that she had grown up in this environment in which women were set up for a kind of exploitation by this early blogging culture that commodified honesty and transparency and, you know, personal confession. And a lot of that overlaps with the wellness influencers and creators who are women that we cover who have to market and sell their internal lives in order to inspire people. But that same process is then weaponized against them. But then you have this quote in Marie Claire where you say, "We've been conditioned to share, to be authentic and real, but doing that makes everything feel personal. And when people spread lies about me on the internet, I used to think, if only if they knew me, if only I could explain myself, if I just gave them a little bit more information, they would understand me. So I gave them more and more of my realest self, trying to correct the record and seize control of my own story. But all it did was give them more and more to take." And so I just wanted to ask about that experience and about how you protect yourself against it at this point.
Well, at this point, I'm at, I don't know, the state of Zen where I just am like, I've stopped trying to kind of like fix all the crazy misinformation on my Wikipedia page. It's just such a losing battle. It's really, really disorienting. And I've talked to, you know, obviously covering the content creator industry, I've see people go through these sort of transitions from private to public figure and sort of the scrutiny that comes with it and how disturbing it can be to see this totally like warped version of yourself represented in the media specifically. I mean, my biggest qualm is not so much with people on the internet, and I couldn't get into this as much in Marie Claire as I wanted to, but my issue is with the media itself and the abhorrent way they cover these harassment campaigns. They often re-victimize women. They often reveal highly personal information. I mean, one of the worst mistakes I think I've ever made in my career is trusting an MSNBC journalist named Morgan Radford, who I do not think should be able to practice journalism. She produced one of the worst segments I've ever seen about online harassment, where she not only misgendered, Kate, who was also in the segment with me, but totally misrepresented everything I said in that interview to kind of make it seem like I gave a shit about like Twitter,
wow,
people saying things about me on Twitter. And it ultimately, what she did, she clipped this part right at the end of a 3.5 hour long interview where I like, for one moment, like, break. And that, right after that, I say like, let's stop the interview because I was upset. I had actually just lost a friend, whatever. And of course, what do? They clip that and replay it a zillion times on cable news. And that sort of exploitation is what so many women, I mean, it just gave me so much empathy for what these other women have gone through that are victims of stalking, harassment, internet attacks, people like Zoe and others, you know, that lived through Gamergate, like just watching the media exploit these women and sort of traumatize them and cause immense harm because they also accelerate these harassment campaigns. Or they ask you to like justify yourself. And it's disturbing. And at this point now, I see this version of myself sort of, this is what I was writing about in that piece, is like you just sort of see this version of yourself represented in the public consciousness or the media environment, especially like on Fox News. Like I think the version of me that exists in the minds of like the right-wing media consumers is just not based in reality. And there's no amount of information or debunking that I can do to convince these people that I'm not like the second coming of the devil or something. I don't know.
You know, you made a joke about being in a Zen place about it, but I think that's kind of a profound moment to recognize that there's a lot of aggression pointed at your name and your image, and that has nothing to do with you as a person. And I'm wondering, like, is that something that is with you now? Does that give you a certain amount of, I don't know, peace or confidence?
But I think to get to that place, I had to develop the most insanely strong sort of sense of self. And that's the only way to get through it. I mean, I think as somebody that also has the benefit of writing about online harassment and have sort of like speaking to women for years, I mean, I joined a support group when I was going through the worst of it. And to me, it's also, it wasn't so much the worst of it on me. I can handle a lot. I can handle being swatted or whatever. Like, but it was what was being done to my family members that was really upsetting, and having my parents driven out of their home in the middle of the night multiple times at gunpoint, and you know, all of the horrible stuff that my family members, extended aunts and uncles, had to endure, and the lies and conspiracies spread about them that have affected their careers, and you know, feeling like you're a liability. I felt like I was like poison, and anybody that, you know, and so I really self-isolated, and that was really bad. And yeah, I think that the only way is through. And I was like, whatever, okay, just going to get through it. And I think actually living in LA has helped, because there's a lot of, I mean, celebrity culture sucks and I'm not like, you know, a fan of it, but I think there's a lot of people in LA, at least the people that I talked to, that really helped me through it, that had been through like really bad, like tabloid news cycles because they're famous in some way, and sort of had got through it. And yeah, it's hard. But of course, those people are multimillionaires who also have endless assistants and people to like help them sort of like get to that better place. Most journalists don't. I'm more well-resourced than most people, but you know, most of the people that are targets in these types of campaigns don't have that kind of support. And so they remove themselves. They retract and remove themselves.
Taylor, thank you so much for sharing all of that. And thank you. Yeah.
But I'm good. Don't worry.
Thank you for sharing, and thank you for joining us today. I highly recommend your book to everyone. I really enjoyed it. Even as someone who has been extremely online, my father was a computer programmer. I've been with computers since the 80s, and I still learn so much. So I really appreciate you and your reporting and your book. So again, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun. And I also just want to let people know I have a YouTube channel now. So please, please, please subscribe. I'm trying to get to the 10,000 subscriber mark right now. It's just Taylor Lorenz on YouTube.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Conspirituality. Join us next Thursday when Mallory DeMille returns to talk about the sordid world of coffee enemas. Or we'll see you over on Patreon.